Good morning, everyone. I'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order. Today, it's April 1st, 2022. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Mr. Brinks, can you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson.
I'm here.
Carlson is present. Representative Nash.
Present.
Nash is present. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Bonner is present. Representative Joskowski.
Present.
Joskowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Cleavorn. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick is present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason is present. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley is present. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski present.
Pawlowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Quam is present. And I have just admitted Representative Cleavorn, so I will mark her as present. With that, Chair, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Members, the first item on our agenda is the approval of minutes. Representative Carlson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Actually, Mr. Chair, when rearranging my desktop here, I did not.
How about Representative Elkins? Did you get a chance?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I will move them.
Representative Elkins moves the minutes, approval of the minutes from March 31st. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. Representative Cleavorn, you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, technical difficulties this morning with my computer, and I just want to be marked present for the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you for checking, but we did mark you as present. We
thank
saw you
so
coming
much.
On as the beginning of the meeting.
Thank
the first
you.
Bill, the first bill we have on our agenda this morning is House File 4661, Representative Lislegard, and I will move House File 4661 to be referred to the General Register. And Representative Lislegard, we have a show an A2 amendment. Do you want that put on first, or do you want to describe the bill first?
No, you can add that now, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the A2 amendment, and you want to describe what the amendment does.
The amendment strikes population of 75,000, allowing any community to choose whether or not to participate in this legislation.
Thank you, Representative. Members, if you want to unmute, all in favor of the A2 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author wants, please unmute and say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. Representative Lislegard, describe your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill aims to update a statute written in 1909. Minnesota Statute 465.50 was written into law over 110 years ago, which only allows a city to spend up to $300 on a Memorial Day. In today's dollars, that would be right around $10,000. So in a proactive approach, a legislative update to this statute is being requested to allow spending up to $10,000 by a local government for a Memorial Day. This change would not cost the state of Minnesota anything, only provides limited increase. And me, along with others, believe strongly that our veterans and fallen heroes deserve that opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Lislegard. Members, any questions? Gesundheit. Members, any questions?
Oh, sorry, Beth.
Seeing no hands jumping up, this will be a quickie. I'll renew my motion that House File 4661, as amended, be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Joskowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn, aye.
Cleborn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative New Brindley.
Mason votes aye. And do I need to move the local government report for this bill?
Ah, thanks for that, Representative. Sorry about that. I didn't see that. We need to adopt the division report before we vote on this. So let's go back. Representative Mason, you want to move the division report for this, for 4661?
I move the local government report on this 4661.
Thank you. Members, again, I'm mute. All in favor of the division report, please say aye.
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 And with that, I'll move House File 4661 to be referred to the General Register, and we'll redo the vote on the amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment that we've already voted on once, please unmute and say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The amendment's adopted, and I'll renew my motion that House File 4661, as amended, be referred to the General Register. And Mr. Brinks, if you want to start the roll again.
Yes, thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
She had to step out, so excuse her.
Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn, aye.
Cleborn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason votes aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Chair with a vote of 12 ayes and one excuse, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. And thank you, Representative Lislegarde. You're on your way to the General Register. Now that we're off to such a thundering start, our next bill on the agenda is House File 4663, Representative Zhang. I'll move the bill to have it in front of us. We're going to lay this bill over. So, Representative Zhang, if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I have House File 4663 here. It's a bill on the military pay differential. Right now, the state pays employees in reserve forces who report to active service the difference between their state pay and active service pay. This is referred to as military pay differential. It is the responsibility of each state entity to ensure it accurately and consistently determines eligibility and calculates and pay military pay differential to their state employees. MMB provides guidance to state entities about how to pay this calculation, how to make this calculation. The OLA conducted an internal controls review on military salary differential pay and determined that there had been inconsistencies and a lack of clarity in the calculations of the salary differential payments. Since the audit, MMB developed improved guidance to provide greater clarity and training for state agencies. And this bill incorporates those changes. And I have Mr. Don Kerr here with me that can go over some of the specifics about the bill.
I've got thrusted three testifiers.
Yes.
If you want, we can start with Don Kerr.
Brita Wrighton. Oh. Deputy Commissioner.
Okay, then we'll start. I'll do it in the order that's on my list then. Brita Rattan, if you want to identify yourself or proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Britta Raton. I am Deputy Commissioner at MMB. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. As the representative stated, the OLA conducted an audit of military salary differential pay. And again, this pay is when it's paid out to someone in a reserve force that is on active duty. And it's the difference between their active military duty salary and the salary they would have been paid as an active state employee. The OLA reviewed all of these payments from July 1st, 2015 through March 31st, 2020. And over this time period, 83 employees were paid a little over $1.2 million under the program. But the OLA found in their review that MMB's guidance was not sufficient to ensure that there was a consistent application of the calculation or the law. And there's really a number of reasons for the complexity of administering this program. The first is that the majority of the overpayments identified by the OLA were based on a service member being paid the differential for service that's not eligible. And eligibility is based on active service. And according to the language of the law, it excludes various forms of training from eligible service. So the OLA recommended as part of their report that military service orders be required in order to help document eligibility of the service prior to receiving the pay differential. And that requirement is part of the language change included in this bill. I do want to highlight, and I think Don Kerr from Military Affairs could explain this better, but just receiving a copy of military orders will not necessarily make this determination always clear cut. It's my understanding that there are forms of active service that also include training. So that this will continue to be an area of focus for agencies and where MMB will have to help aid agencies as we implement the program. Another area of complexity is the calculation of determining base pay or the amount the employee would have earned in active state service. Dori Leland is here and she can provide more detail on this, but there was too much room in our earlier guidance for interpretation around the determination of the last 3 months of active service and what payroll codes to use versus what payroll codes to exclude, particularly related to overtime and shift differentials. We've since updated and refined our guidance and worked with the agencies involved in line with the OLA recommendation. But there's also language changes in the bill to make the calculation more straightforward, including a definition of 3 months as three calendar months and allowing overtime pay to be included in the calculation, because that exclusion of overtime pay was sometimes difficult to administer and to identify what was considered overtime versus other sources of pay. And lastly, I want to highlight that the bill also includes language that makes it clear that agencies do not need to try to recollect overpayments that were identified by the OLA. Current law would require that agencies go back and collect back from these service members overpayments that were paid out back to a number of years. We would prefer to not have agencies collect those payments back from service members, and so there's language in the bill that makes it clear that that's not required. So Dori Leland is here. She can provide an update of our revised guidance and our work with agencies so far to ensure that any underpayments have been addressed.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Leland, if you want to, again, identify yourself for the tape and then proceed. And hopefully we get better luck with your audio than we've had earlier. Ms. Leland.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Is my audio working?
It sounds better now, yes.
Great, thanks. Good morning. I am Dori Leland, the Enterprise Director for Employee Classification and Compensation at MMB. Deputy Commissioner Raton has already covered much of the background related to the changes that are in the bill before you today. Before going into a little more detail about the intent of those changes, I'd like to take an opportunity to update you on the steps that MMB has taken to remedy the issues that were identified by the OLA. First, we met with all of the agencies that were identified in the report to review how the OLA's findings related to their specific issues of underpayment and overpayment. And we worked with individual agencies to correct their calculations and to issue any underpayments to eligible employees. To the best of my knowledge, all underpayment issues have now been addressed. Agencies have not yet begun the overpayment collection process pending the outcome of this bill. Second, MMB drafted and posted updated guidance for agencies related to the calculation of military differential payments. The updated guidance addresses the ambiguities that our prior guidance that was identified by the OLA from our prior guidance. The new guidance clarifies the boundaries of that three-month look-back period required for calculation. It identifies through a series of spreadsheets the several hundred earn codes that should or should not be included in the calculation for the total gross earnings piece of the existing language. We provided clarity on the treatment of retroactive pay increases, and we also gave additional guidance on how to map the state's 26 pay periods to the military payment schedule that only has 24 pay periods. The changes that we are recommending in this bill are based upon both the OLA's findings as well as our experience working with agencies to address the issues that were identified. The changes are intended to make the process of calculating military pay differential more streamlined for the agencies and therefore less prone to inadvertent calculation errors. So if we turn to the language of the changes proposed in the bill itself, at lines 1.7 and 1.8, we're recommending a couple things. First, a shorter time frame for employees to request the differential payment. Under existing language, employees can request payment for service dating back to 2003. Normal statute of limitations for payment claims are 2 years, and so that change is intended to bring it more in line with other similar types of payment requests. And as Commissioner Raton referenced, the language also includes a new requirement to provide a copy of military orders, and we're hoping that that will take care of almost all of the overpayment issues that arose as part of the OLA's report. Second, at lines 2.2 and 2.3 of the bill, we're recommending that total gross earnings be included into the differential calculation rather than trying to distinguish the regular and overtime payments. We do have hundreds of earn codes. Each time we settle a contract, we may add additional earn codes into our system, and it's not always straightforward whether or not each type of premium pay should be considered overtime or not, and so we're recommending that simplification. Third, at line 2.4, we're recommending a clarification for the confusion that the OLA identified around how to calculate the three-month look-back period. We're recommending calendar months. The OLA identified confusion and mixed practice about whether the month means the first day of the preceding month or a month prior to whenever the deployment began, and so that change is intended to add some clarity to that piece. And then finally, at lines 3.1 to 3.5, for the reasons discussed, we are proposing language that would exempt agencies from their obligation to collect any overpayments that were inadvertently made to employees during their military service.
Thank you, Ms. Leland. Next, we have Mr. Don Kerr from the Department of Military Affairs. And if you can, Mr. Kerr, are you still here?
Mr. Chair, I'm here.
Oh, thank you. There. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, and I'm here to provide supporting answers to any questions that the committee may have regarding military orders. And we were one of the agencies that participated along with MMB in this work to kind of come up with these solutions. And we're completely confident we don't have a 100% solution, but we think this is great progress in the right direction. We fully support what MMB is doing, both with the recommended legislative changes and also with the practices that they're proposing to implement. And what we found and what we've been finding is there is a remarkable lack of standardization in the Department of Defense among orders producing authorities. And sometimes it's really difficult to identify. One of the things that really was a sticking point was orders for training. A lot of times agencies will use training orders because they may have a pot of money that is for training that has money in it, and they don't have money for operational needs. And so they would expediently cut an order from a training fund and then hopefully would fix that later, but in some cases allow that to happen and send people into combat using training funding. And so We were pretty sure that having a copy of the orders would help alleviate some of the differentiation of whether the service was truly for training or not. And so a lot of complexities with that. And I guess I'll just stop there and see if there are any questions that there may be from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Any questions, members? Any questions? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zhang. I appreciate the bill, and I certainly especially appreciate holding service members harmless for the mistakes of MMB. Certainly, you know, I mean, I would assume that we're talking about a lot of middle-class families, and this could be a significant hit to these families to have to pay this back. I'm a little concerned. It seems that legislatively, in the language here, there are very few changes to correct the problem. I mean, there's the copy of the military orders, and there's figuring in the overtime pay, but those are the only two pieces that really are changing process legislatively. And so I'm wondering, Ms. Raitan, again, in no way do I think that the service members should be held accountable for the mistakes of the bureaucracy, but I'm wondering, can you give us a little bit more detail on how exactly we are fixing this problem moving forward? Because, again, there's very little in the actual language to do that.
Ms. Raitan.
Certainly. So, Representative, the vast majority of the overpayments were based on ineligible service for the military pay differential. And one of the kind of difficulties here is agencies distinguishing training versus active service. And so the military orders is the best solution we have, requiring a copy of military orders in order to define that. But I do think one of the difficulties here with administration is that the state law is drawing a distinction that is not always clear from the federal entity that is issuing the orders. And that's what Don Kerr was referencing. The other piece that is happening, though, and Dory Leland can speak more about this, is a kind of a lot more granular detail in our guidance about what earn codes to include or exclude. And so the underpayments, that was more the problem with the underpayments, is what earn codes were agencies including from our payroll system to calculate that kind of the amount employees were earning while on active state service. So that granular detail of the guidance is also part of the solution. So that is not in actual law, but it would be the way MMB provides the guidance.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, or perhaps Mr. Kerr, talk more about what you said, that that state law is drawing a distinction here between federal? Can you talk a little bit more about the confusion there, and what is being done to help alleviate that portion of the problem?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, I think I can provide some light on that. So in state statute, active service is defined specifically to delineate between active service for training and active service as most of us would envision it, mobilized and deployed somewhere. For example, when a service member joins the National Guard, they have to go off to initial entry training where they go through basic training and advanced individual training. And the intent of the legislature at the time the law was crafted was to exclude that initial entry training from reimbursement because I'm not exactly sure why, but it makes a certain amount of sense that it is kind of an expectation. It's normal service that's not above and beyond what a service member originally signed up for. And now in the era of persistent conflict, that almost sounds a little bit funny because 20 years ago, we just really didn't deploy and go anywhere. And service members were going off to annual training. They were going off to their inactive duty training for drills. And at that time, the intent of the legislature was not to use those short periods of training duty and that initial entry training duty as circumstances for which they would be compensated with differential pay.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so some of that training then was reimbursed. Where can I ask, Mr. Chair, thank you. Can I ask, and I apologize that I don't have the actual language in front of me. You said the intent was to exclude the initial training. Is the language clear on that?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, my experience is that the language is never clear enough, no matter what we're talking about when it comes to law. But of course, we've been reluctant to do a lot of changing of that because of the second and third order consequences whenever you open that can of worms. It would appear to be clear until we got some of the creative order writing. For example, we would see service members ordered into a continuous period active duty with a training component on the front of that order and a deployment component on the back. And that's one of the areas where it gets really difficult to determine what is and is not eligible for reimbursement. No matter how the language gets crafted, there's always going to be an exception. I was having a long conversation yesterday with one of my employees, and one of the things that we changed in a similar but different part of the law, actually very close to that, regarding military leave and being able to use that. It's just never easy. We think the language is pretty good, but it is something we could continue to look at as we move forward. Again, from an agency perspective, we think that between the statutory changes and the policy changes that MMB is applying, that will allow the agencies to be much more consistent in their application of this law, and think will alleviate the concerns that the OLA found.
Representative Brindley and members, we've got a number of other bills, and this one's being laid over, so if we need to do more work on it, we can. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my last question then would be, Ms. Raitan, do you have an idea, or maybe Mr. Kerr, I don't know, do you have an idea if we change the statute to just include the training, because certainly, you know, these service members are providing a service to our state and our country, whether they are doing that through the training that they are receiving to be prepared or through an actual deployment. Do we have, and maybe Representative Zhang, you looked into this as well, do we have any idea of what the cost of that would be to just include the training and eliminate this portion of the confusion?
Mr. Tan.
Understanding that there's no fiscal note.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. That was actually something we discussed. I want to defer to Don Kerr because there were some concerns about doing that. I think there's some other allowed time that employees can take within state contracts for military training, and maybe Dory can help with that as well. But it seemed like it wasn't as straightforward as it may appear on its face.
Mr. Kerr.
And Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, so if the training caveat were removed, that would also then include inactive duty training, so weekend drills, and we would get into a lot of complexity about which service members were actually scheduled to work weekends and we're now doing calculations for 2 days of training, and that gets really complicated. And we really do believe that because military leave is provided, 15 days of military leave is provided, that should cover most of the requirements for the typical service member who to be reimbursed for that time directly. And so they'd be paid their full wage for that period.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the answers.
Representative Bonner.
Just to that point, is there a reason we can't include the words including deployment or something of that nature to make it more clear what we're referencing? Because you said that sometimes an order will have training on the front end, a deployment on the back end, but is there some reason we can't add those words to make it more concise in Minnesota statute?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner, so the challenge in that is what you're doing now is taking an existing defined term in state law, and in another place in state law, you're going to modify that term for a specific purpose. And I mean, I would let the reviser speak to the potential perils of that, but it's generally not something that the agency would support with regard to modification of Minnesota Statute 190.05.
Representative Bonner, that might be something we can look at, or that, again, this is being laid over for possible inclusion or inclusion in somebody else's bill.
I just wanted to suggest that, you know, if the statute is part of the problem and it is not clear, then perhaps we should be addressing the statute and making sure that it is crisp and it is clear and that it's consistent with other states.
Thank you, Representative. With that, Representative Zhang, if you want to quickly wrap up and we'll lay this over. Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate the questions. We will look into it and work on it, but I think what's important here is that it's taking in the recommendations from the OLA, and we're looking to hold harmless those service members that had received overpayments. And appreciate the testifiers and look forward to hearing from you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. With that, we'll lay this bill over. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 4497. Representative Pinto, I'll move to refer House File 4497 to the Early Childhood Committee. And Representative Pinto, we have an A4 amendment. Is that your amendment? Do we need to put that on?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
I'll move the A4 amendment, and if you want to briefly describe what that does.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and good to be with you and everybody. The A4 amendment has a bit of cleanup, but the main thing is that we identified the need for a special revenue account to be able to fund the work that I'll describe in the bill. And so I'd appreciate members' support to at least get the bill in that shape, and then we can have a conversation about it.
So members, the A4 amendment is in front of us. If you want to unmute, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. Representative Pinto, if you want to briefly describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 4497 comes most immediately out of a report that that the legislature ordered last spring from MMB to examine the governance of early childhood programs, which in our state are quite complex and fragmented. This is true in every state for reasons that we probably won't get into this morning, but I'm happy to at any time with anybody. In the course of that governance report, MMB identified that concerns about IT, and data sharing and IT systems are a real challenge in these programs, and went off quite a bit on that. Agency leaders identified that as a concern, and that really built on an OLA report from 2018 that again identified IT and data challenges. In the course of following up from that governance report, it seemed to me, and then in working with agencies and with stakeholders, that we had a real need to at least to aim at that problem. And so what the bill does is it directs that there be a plan developed to address these concerns, and that we be able to take steps to implement that plan. As I'm sure you all are aware far better than me, it's hard to know what to implement if you don't have a plan. But on the other hand, we did want to make sure that we took steps forward on the implementation, which is why the amendment created the special revenue fund. So if the Early Childhood Committee, where the money would come out of, and not your committee, if we felt that that was appropriate, we could put money in that fund and have it be available to get this work done over a number of years. More details, Mr. Chair, from my two testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Pinto. Well, the first testifier I have is Ramsey County Commissioner Nicole Freedom. If you want to identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and representatives. I am Ramsey County Commissioner Nicole Fretham. And before I served on the Board of Commissioners in Ramsey County, I worked for the Minnesota Department of Human Services as a supervisor in the Child Care Assistance Program. And before that, I worked as a child care provider in an accredited child care program in St. Paul. So I could talk all day about the IT needs of early childhood systems in Minnesota, but I only have 2 minutes, so forgive me if I speak fast. I'll refer you to the report that Representative Pinto mentioned about governance in early childhood systems, and also the 2018 OLA audit of early childhood programs and the 2019 OLA assessment of CCAP internal controls to emphasize why this is a really important bill to do for complexity and program integrity reasons. And what I want to focus on is I don't think the legislature understands how old some of this technology is that our programs are being operated on, not just early learning programs, but all of our human services programs, and how wasteful this is, especially for us counties as the administrators of these programs. I would love to be able to be in person and boot up the MAXIS system for you, but I can't. I can send you a screenshot of the screen, but it looks like a Tron, basically. And this is what we are distributing hundreds of millions of dollars in assistance to families through in Minnesota. It's built on COBOL technology. And if you remember at the start of the pandemic, the number of states that were having challenges due to unemployment insurance needs, most of those were related to COBOL program systems because the folks that program those systems are retiring and no longer working, and they don't train for how to program that anymore. To me, this is our current technology systems across human services programs is a technology equivalent of the 35W bridge collapse waiting to happen. If those systems go down and can't be fixed, we will have thousands of families without critical assistance to meet their basic needs. And the reason I talk about that is because although the CCAP system is called MEC squared, all MEC squared is a pretty face on top of the MAXIS system. And this MAXIS system was built in 1991 and has been updated twice for Y2K because no one thought that we would still be using it in 2020 and was about to shut the whole system down. Further, it's incredibly wasteful. Being a caseworker is an incredibly demanding job. You're dealing with people in crisis all day, every day, and really complex programs that you want to make sure that you're following the rules. If we have someone that we're trying to hire as a financial assistance worker to administer CCAP, and they're coming in with maybe a master's degree in their mid-20s, the first day of work, they're going to be trained on how to use a system that's older than them. This is why we have some of the highest turnover in our financial assistance workers' jobs, because what they want to do is help people, and instead they're having to learn ancient technology. And on top of it, it's wasteful. We now have an online application that's really effective for families, but when that comes to the county, that all has to get hand-entered into our system, which is rife for data entry errors and other problems where we might have ineligible families receive assistance or vice versa. And on top of that, it's just a waste of time. We have the technology to automate that so our caseworkers could actually be working with and helping families. And because it's so cumbersome and time-wasting, we end up having families who don't get their applications approved in time, and then they get kicked off the program or they don't get benefits. They have to reapply. So then we have caseworkers entering the same family information into the system multiple times before they actually get benefits. And in that interim period, if a family lose benefits, if they lose their child care, they might also lose their job, their housing, their transit, and then we're having to invest so much more money into getting this family back on track, where if we had an efficient system that was easy to use and easy to train, we wouldn't be dealing with the waste of turnover and data entry and data errors and delays in programs. As a county commissioner, like, I cannot tell you how important it is that we're able to have our caseworkers do those jobs and not fight with an elephant of a system that is, you know, old enough to get a mortgage. I probably exceeded my 2 minutes, so I'll stop now, but I stand for questions. And like Representative Pinto, I will talk all day to you about the need for this.
And we don't have time for that this morning to be talking all day. Next person on my list is Cisa Keller. Ms. Keller, if you want to identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Absolutely. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cisa Keller, and I'm the executive leader of Early Childhood Quality Development at Think Small. Think Small is a nonprofit organization working towards our strategic plan population level result of all Minnesota children ready for kindergarten. We do this by strengthening families, preparing providers, and catalyzing change. And I'm here today also in support of House File 4977. Commissioner Fretham really spoke to the nuts and bolts of this. I'll just add a few more comments to what she said. But as an administrator of early learning scholarships from the Minnesota Department of Education, as well as child care assistance from DHS and several other government contracts from a variety of state agencies, we interact with state technologies regularly. And the age of the systems, as Commissioner Fretham mentioned, and the lack of communication between them makes it very difficult for our staff, for child care providers, and parents alike. We appreciate the efforts that the Minnesota Department of Education and the Department of Human Services have already undertaken to better coordinate, and we greatly appreciate the work of the Governor's Children Cabinet to better communicate and collaborate across all state agencies. House File 4997 would continue to support these efforts. Improving technology and data practices will benefit the field now by making it easier for all parents or all parties to access information they need. It will also incredibly be beneficial if Congress passes new investments in early care and education. Again, the age of the systems, the lack of the communication between them makes it very challenging for staff to do their job and for parents to be able to do their job as parents. Improving the data system and the technology for early childhood programs will not solve all of our problems in the field. Financial investments are still urgently needed. However, this is a huge step in the right direction. And I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. Representative Elkins, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, there actually are a few members of this committee who do appreciate these issues and spend a fair amount of time on them. So we're happy to have these kind of issues being brought to the fore. And this is, I think, as a couple of the testifiers mentioned, both a technical issue and an institutional issue. So the varying interpretations of the Data Practices Act among different departments of state government is a big part of the issue as well. But this is an issue I have been wading into myself, and I know that there are, you know, a number of people who are very interested in this topic, whose hearts are in the right places, and want to see this initiative move forward. And ironically, one of the best examples of data integration across departments is the Student Longitudinal Educational Data System, which basically tracks students from K, you know, through college. And so the pre-K stuff that you guys are addressing here is a huge gap in what is otherwise a pretty good exemplar for a multi-agency data sharing. So thank you for bringing this forward. I will be voting for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Did you say that you're creating a special revenue fund for this, or how are you doing that again? And then, Mr. Chair, I'll have another question on follow-up.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. Yes, so the amendment, so now the amended bill would create a special revenue fund within minute called, I'm going to see if I can find the name of it, but the Early Childhood Information Technology Account, which would fund both the development of the plan and then the implementation of the plan to the extent that there's money available in the account.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there a reason that it's a special revenue fund and not just an appropriation? And thank you. And I'll have more.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. So the concern is that, so what I was hoping that we could do is appropriate funds right now to develop and implement the plan. The concern that the pushback on that was that we won't know how much. We couldn't know the cost of implementation without knowing the plan. So the work has to be done on the plan. And in order to keep forward momentum, you may have heard with the OLA report, et cetera, like it's and Commissioner Fretham's remarks that this is the sort of thing that can sit around for a long time. And so my thinking is that if it turns out, and again, we'll have to see if we can make it go through the budget, but if it turns out that we can make investments now or have funds available now, then the thinking is let's have that money be available so that the plan that gets developed can in fact be implemented.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not the craziest about that, but I will say this is something that is an important change and an important update. The to the author, or to maybe somebody from the administration, talk about the cost to update currently. Maybe the county commissioner. You know, so my experience is if this goes sideways, if this has something go wrong with it, you're likely to be hiring people out of our retirement village to come in and fix the program because COBOL is a dead language. It's almost as dead as Latin. And the cost is going to be staggering. I know many, many retirees that were COBOL programmers that actually look forward to the day when things break so they can go in and, as one of them called it, make a lot of beer money. So if you could maybe outline what that cost is versus the cost avoidance that you would have by updating the system.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say, just at a first glance, it seems to me that, yeah, that's such a strong argument for doing this, right? Because we want to make sure that we get these systems fixed while those folks are still alive, because if we don't fix it now, then we won't be able to go to the retirement village. But I'll maybe turn, perhaps Commissioner Fretham would be the right person to help answer that question, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, briefly.
I don't know if I could say the exact cost. I believe, and the department in Minute would have this data if it was requested, I believe it was over $1 million just to make the refix for the Y2K issue. What happened was in 2019, they realized as people were entering due dates for babies, because some of our programs expected mothers get benefits, that it was breaking the system. The system basically shut down when that happened, because when it was fixed for Y2K, the switch date was set to 20. So once a year ended in the numbers to zero, the system reverted it to 1920. And so they had to pull all the programmers they had off all of our other projects, including important program integrity projects, to refix Maxis for Y2K. And I believe it was over $1 million spent just to refix that piece, in addition to the fact that it delayed multiple important program integrity changes in the system.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are important things for us to be talking about. State government is rife with this stuff. We've got programs that are old, outdated, can't be patched, can't be updated, are really good targets for compromise. So as much as I hate to spend money on these things, if we are to be delivering these services, and that's something that we can debate at another time, we have to have software that works, and anything built on COBOL is a hot mess that is just waiting to happen. So thanks.
And Representative Nash, this is something I've said many times. One thing that we in government do at times is we build something, put it on and run it way past its useful life. And we don't do like businesses do, invest in making sure that our systems are up to date and continually updating them. And again, that's a problem we have when it gets into funding these things. So Representative Bonner, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reliable, consistent funding for IT. That is the hot topic of the day for certain. I just wanted to briefly weigh in and say that, you know, one of the things that's very striking as I served on the Early Childhood Committee is that it is very clear that there is a real need to increase the efficiency of our process and the systems that we use to actually determine eligibility, to get kiddos to the right services and at the right time in the right place. And that has really been a huge issue. It's clear that this bill is about laying the foundation of that and doing the discovery that's necessary. So I highly support that. One of the questions that I actually did have for Representative Pinto is, and perhaps staffers, is, are we currently working with some teams on Minute? Do we have some process improvement folks that are working with us as well to try and determine the right solutions and the right path for us to go down to make sure that we are using the most of each of those dollars?
Representative Pinto, is there anybody here for a minute that could answer that, or take a stab at it yourself.
Maybe I'll just take a stab at it just to say, Representative Bonner, of course, this work can't start because there's not the, you know, funding and directive for it. But I will note that all the way along, there have been a series of efforts to work on this. And so I'll just say that, you know, the governance report just came out, I think, a month ago. So as far as following up directly on that, you know, that's something that we're now trying to do through this legislation. But I know there have been a series of efforts along the way to have these programs, and just so members are aware, programs doing very similar things in different agencies because we as the legislature have passed that through the years. So there is progress being made. I'm not sure if somebody from Minute can once hop on, Mr. Chair, but otherwise that hopefully we'll have done it.
Representative Bonner, quickly so we can get moved, we can move on.
Thank you. And certainly I will just leave it here. I'll be happy to work with Representative Pinto and other folks to make sure that we're heading down the right path and that we have all the right folks involved to make sure that we are as efficient as possible with every tax dollar we have to determine the right path here. So thank you for all of that. I really do applaud the efforts. And I will say just briefly, COBOL, in fact, in a recent cyber attack, actually saved someone because the hackers didn't know what to do with the COBOL system. But that said, the problem is that we also can't have systems where no one actually knows how to fix it. So that's a huge red flag. So thank you for the bill, Representative Pinto. It's a good bill. I really appreciate the efforts.
And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4497, as amended, be referred to the Early Childhood Committee. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski. Representative Joskowski. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne, aye.
Cleborne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick votes nay. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Representative Joskowski. Chair, with a vote of 10 ayes, 2 nays, and 1 excuse, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the Early Childhood Committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 4441. Representative Mason. And Representative Mason, do you want to move the division report? You're muted, ma'am.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the local government report regarding House File 4441.
The division report's in front of us for House File 4441. If you want to unmute, members, all in favor of the division report, please say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's in front of us. Representative Mason, if you want to move your bill, this is going to the General Register.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do move House File 4441 to the General Register. And House File 40, do we need to vote on this? Or do
no, I you need to first just, you can proceed with your description of the bill.
Okay. House File 4441 is addressing conditions regarding participation of officials in public meetings from a non-public location. And it's basically an expansion of legislation that we passed to cope with COVID. And we do have Commissioner Kathleen Gaylord here to give you the details.
And I have a list. Ms. Gaylord, if you want to proceed, or state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I am Kathleen Gaylord. I am the chair of the Dakota County Board of Commissioners, and I'm also the president of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And I want to thank Representative Mason for authoring House File 4441, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to testify in support of the bill today. This bill is pretty straightforward. It modifies Minnesota's open meeting law to authorize a limited flexibility for members of public bodies to attend their official meetings from a non-public location when that member has been advised by a healthcare professional against being in a public place for personal or family medical reasons. Under the current law, a member of a public body cannot fully participate remotely and fulfill their responsibilities as a local government official when they're faced with some serious medical condition for which their medical advisors have told them they should not be out in public. Some of the conditions this might include are having autoimmune diseases, a post-chemotherapy treatment, certain post-surgical recoveries, or other conditions where, again, the medical professional has advised that public official to at least temporarily not be in public. This proposed change is narrowly crafted and provides some limited flexibility for some real-life medical conditions. It doesn't address every situation, and that's really not its goal. It's really to just provide a reasonable accommodation to public officials for a medical condition that's arisen. We've learned a lot over the last couple of years on how to maintain transparency and continuity of operations, even in the face of personal and community public health crises. House File 4441 applies those lessons and is offering limited flexibility within clear guidelines. The authority is limited to just three times a year, and it has to be under the advisement of a medical professional. The advice must be to that member avoid being in public, but we still take roll call votes. Our regular meetings are all in person, so there's going to be people there and in the room and available to the public if they're there. All the open meeting law requirements, all the protocols are still there. Again, I just want to emphasize that we believe that the technology supports greater flexibility. We've gone a little farther and a little better in dealing with these things than we were in the past, and we shouldn't have to force the public officials to forego participation and put themselves at risk to participate. So, again, this offers a better balance between health and medical realities of daily life, and it's a reasonable accommodation. So, I think. Representative Mason for authoring the bill, and I appreciate the committee's time. Thanks.
With that, I have Mr. Mossman here from the Intercounty Association to answer questions if needed. Representative Quam, you have your hand up. You have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one concern I have is it doesn't appear that this is limited to when it's family. To members of that household or living in the same abode, or that it's even the immediate family. And so that if you are traveling out and about while, you know, delivering a meal or periodic checking, what's preventing you from traveling out and about and actually being accessible to the public? I'm trying to understand why there's no clarification and narrowing on the family component.
Representative Mason.
Okay, I think I'm going to let Commissioner Gaylord address this.
Or Mr. Mossman. I think he was muting.
Okay.
Mr. Mossman, do you want to take that or let the commissioner?
Well, go ahead. Matt, you want to
give
you? They're pointing to you. That's fine.
All right.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Matt Mosman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and thank you, Representative Kwan, for the question. And we did have a bit of discussion about this. The one thing I would say is I think implicit in the medical advice that would come to the member of the public body is that they are advised to not be in public. So the language as it is already structured in law, and we're really retaining the language that is currently in law, we're just preventing its expiration, if you will. Remember, we've already operated on this language in the past. But this language implies, I think, or is clear that if the member is not going in public, that they're remaining in their household. And so it's sort of, I think you're right that it's not explicit, but I think it's fairly clear that if the member is following the advice of their medical practitioner, their medical expert, that they are likely not, the intent is that they're not leaving their home. So it would really apply to individuals that they are with in their home.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're going through the effort of writing this and pushing forward a bill, we should probably improve it by being more clear because there would be interpretations. Plus the definition of medical professional, if you have a aunt that's a retired nurse saying, well, you probably shouldn't, that would be advice from a medical professional. I understand the intent, but I think it needs to be tightened up, ambiguities taken away. Plus, the key to being an elected person serving the people is being in and among the people and interacting with people in order to allow for you to better understand the community. I understand, and it's logical to have some exceptions, especially chemo. We all can write a list, but the bill in its current form allows for some ambiguity, and I think it needs to be tightened up. And that's why I asked the question, and I didn't get reassurances. So I'm sorry. I like the intent, but can't vote for this.
Mr. Chair, can I just quickly respond?
Ms. Commissioner Gaylord.
I don't want to take up a lot of time on this, but on the ground and in real life, most of the constituents are interacting with local government officials with texts and Zoom meetings and using interactive technologies. This bill what happens is when you get this, your doctor says stay home, basically. You cannot, under the current law, participate in the meeting and vote. You can certainly, as a member of the public, watch the meeting. You may even be able to comment in the meeting. But the one thing that the current language does to a local elected official who can't go into a public place is it says you can't vote. So this is to allow a local public official who wants to do their duty, who wants to participate, who wants to vote in a meeting to do that when they're forced to stay home because of medical conditions.
Thank you, Ms. Gaylord. And members, if you look at the language in the bill, it's all current statute. The only thing we're eliminating in the bill is the clause that only applies when a state of emergency has been declared and expires 60 days after that state of emergency. That's what's being removed. Otherwise, everything else is current law.
Well, Mr. Chair, the point was, thank you, Mr. Chair. The point is to tighten up and get rid of ambiguity when we do this. Every time we revisit current statute, we should also look at the broader aspects of that. And that's my whole point, not the intent. And I, as the testifier gave, the intent is understandable. Let's do just a little more precise and concise improvement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Qualm. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo what Representative Qualm has brought forward and will disagree with the commissioner who just testified. Prior to joining the legislature, I was a mayor, and before that, I was a city council member. I did not do Zoom meetings, did not do text phone calls, because I think a good elected official will go out of their way to be in person with somebody, much like we have been saying that we need to hear in the legislature, we need to be in person. And I just think that Representative Qualm makes excellent points, and as a result of the bill and the conversation, I'm voting no.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And I look forward to when this hits the floor, if it hits the floor, that amendment from Representative Qualm. He heard it in local government. He had plenty of time to do that amendment before it got here. So, members, Representative Mason, if you want to do a wrap-up and then renew your motion to send it to the General Register.
Okay, thank you. I do renew my motion to send this House File 4441 to the General Register. And I just want to make a comment. I was on the City Council for 8 years. I can remember missing one meeting, and it was a workshop where I needed to go out of state because my mother was ill. And I am used to dealing with people that act in a professional manner. And while I understand some of the questions, I guess I find it almost insulting, because I think most of us go out of our way to be where we need to be to perform our responsibilities. To me, this bill is allowing for personal and public safety. It's a reasonable adjustment. Members, I ask for your support.
And with that, members, Representative Mason has renewed her motion. Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
No.
Nash votes nay. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne aye.
Cleburne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick no.
Kosnick votes nay. Representative Mason.
Mason aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Qualm.
No.
Qualm votes nay. Representative Joskowski. Joskowski is excused. Chair, with a vote of 8 ayes, 4 nays, and 1 excuse, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the General Register.
Thank you.
Representative Mason, our next bill is House File 4345. Do you want to move the adoption of the division report?
Okay. I move the local government division report for 4445.
The division report's in front of us. Members, if you want to
unmute. Oh, wait a minute. It's 4345. I'm sorry.
4345. Correct. The division report for 4345 is in front of us. Members, if you want to unmute. And all in favor of the division report, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The division report's in front of us. I'll move that House File 4345 be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee, or welcome back to the committee. Please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4345, as is presented to you, is due in part to PTSD and presumption changes in the work comp statutes and the recent increase in the volume of claims. The time horizon for work comp benefits and therefore the supporting investment of funds to cover those claims has lengthened. Now, under current law, having a portfolio under that only yields 2 or 3% per year does not keep up with the long-term needs of those claims. And without modification to how Chapter 118A, there will be pressure to have longer duration of fixed income investments. And what I mean by that is the purchase of, say, 10-year U.S. Treasuries instead of a 5-year U.S. Treasury ladder or portfolio. Longer durations under current law bring with it their own set of risks, some of which are as volatile as equities. House File 4345 would authorize the local government insurance trusts utilized by both cities, counties, and townships to have the option to invest assets per the current law, authorization of the State Board of Investment, including corporate bonds, exchange-traded funds, etc. The ability to realize higher investment yields over the long term means, quite honestly, an opportunity for stable or lower property taxes based upon the claims. The League Insurance Trust Board has a comprehensive investment policy that the board reviews annually with the assistance of our investment consultants and general counsel and with the input of our actuary and other historical investment risk portfolios that are appropriate for the investment duration under consideration. I have Mr. Gary Carlson with me from the State Board of a County Association. For further questions, happy to take questions. Fairly straightforward bill. Thank you for your consideration.
And Representative Albright, this is similar to the bill we heard from Representative Freiberg, and I understand Freiberg's bill was amended onto your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, that is correct. Representative Freiberg's language was amended on in local government.
And that bill we heard earlier and passed on to the General Register that dealt with allowing cities with a specific bond rating to be able to invest in broader things to, again, bring in more money to those funds and to alleviate some pressure on local taxpayers. Members, any questions of the bill? Representative Nash.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. I just wanted to go on record as saying I think this is a really horrible bill. This is misguided. It is something that I think should be sent back to committee and reworked on. I am surprised that you're bringing it, and just wanted to make that point on this day, April 1st, that we should not be doing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since the other bill was amended in, I have some, you're allowing local, you know, cities that haven't had this exposure and experience to get involved. And I just would feel better if there was some language for that broader bill that was amended in that had some sort of a transition period with a much more restrictive investments until they got used to it and went up the learning curve before they were more fully open into the risks. And I'm not positive what that language might be, but you know, that was the one concern with a previous bill that was amended in. And I was wondering if there's any words of comfort from the author.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Representative Palm, thank you for the question. The language that is before you includes permissive language that avails any local municipality to adopt what is called an investment policy statement, which in a sense, first and foremost, actually apprises them of the risks associated and attended to any type of an investment that they might put in their portfolio. That being said, many of the local municipalities that are utilizing these tools of the trade, so to say, are also contracting with an investment consultant that would have expertise in this field, acting as a fiduciary on behalf of the local municipality that provide that investment expertise to them so that when they're taking a look at their risk-reward profile, they are fully aware of that and acting in the best interests of their community and those that are making claims against this insurance trust.
And and the bill, as I'm sure I brought it up here, that was amended into it, it's also that they allowed them to invest in the with the State Board of Investment. And so Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate that this is in a better form than the other bill. I'm paranoid and worried about mistakes being made, but that hopefully the benefit outweighs the risk and we don't see anything. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Members, any other questions? Or any other first April 1st comments? Representative Elkins, quickly. You're muted.
If I would remember to unmute, yes. I'm going to vote for this, but I do share some of the same qualms that Representative Nash does, that cities are requesting this authority at this particular point in the economic cycle. I think this is probably the wrong time for cities or anybody to be, chasing yield by taking on higher risk. So I do hope that this authority is used very judiciously.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 4345 be referred to the General Register. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski is excused. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Claiborne.
Claiborne, aye.
Claiborne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, aye.
Pulowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Chair, with a vote of 12 ayes and one excuse, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. You're on your way to the General Register, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The last bill we have on our agenda this morning is House File 4451, Representative Eklund and Chair Eklund. And I'll move to have the bill in front of us. The intent is to lay this over. And Representative Eklund, you want to describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This legislation provides the Commissioner of Department of Natural Commissioner of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation with the authority to design and implement programs to manage employee separation, retention, and recruitment. Mr. Stroman would have been very surprised if this would have been for her. Anyway, the agency currently has 12 employees from a total agency complement of 42 that are at or very near retirement age. These programs would assist in the agency's ability to strategically transition our aging workforce in this unprecedented labor market. A controlled turnover / recruitment process is efficient. It is valued by employees. It allows for workforce planning in a competitive labor market and positions the agency for success during a transition. Over the long term, programs under the authority can provide flexibility in the use of compensation and reward incentives that support retention strategies and best practices, such as linking compensation and benefits payouts to years of service. If granted this authority, the agency will work with our legislative board and the IRRB. The agency's dedicated revenues from taconite production taxes in lieu of local property taxes would fund these programs. The cost-justified programs would be approved through our normal budgeting process, which includes approval of the IRRB board and the governor. The legislature has previously approved separation programs for the agency, most recently in 2017. Mr. Chair, the agency is neutral on this. This is not a IRRR bill. This is a result of a conversation that Senator Bach and I have had with agency staff, and we thought it would be looking at losing 25% of the agency workforce over the next year or two. We thought it would be a prudent measure to get this in front of the State Gov Committee and Legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Question, members. Questions. Seeing no hands popping up. Representative Elkins, if you want to just give a brief wrap up and then we can lay this over.
Eklund.
Eklund. What did I say? Elkins? Sorry about that. They're both on my screen. They're on top of each other. They're too close to names. Representative Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's the trouble with what I call Hollywood Squares as well. We get confused with names and little pictures of people. But I think this is a good bill to help the agency out. There's no effect on your budget, Mr. Chair, going forward. So I would appreciate the support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. With that, members, we'll lay this bill over. Thank you, Representative Eklund. Thank you, Commissioner Metza, for coming down. And with that, members, our next meeting is next Tuesday, April 5th. House File 4293 is our vehicle bill that we'll be hearing. Looking forward to getting the omnibus bill put out or released with the DE amendment for 4293 on Sunday evening. Tuesday, we'll roll the bill out and we'll take public testimony. Wednesday of next week, we will continue public testimony and start up markup on that so that we'll be meeting Wednesday morning. And Thursday, we'll finish our markup and refer the bill to Ways and Means. And that's our agenda for next week. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in anticipation of that, and by the fact that you just said that it's going to be going to Ways and Means, can you tell us what the budget target that you received for your bill is? And will the minority party be receiving what that is for this committee prior to the release of your bill?
Representative Nash, we've been instructed not to release our targets yet. The speaker and the chair of Ways and Means are going to be dealing with that shortly.
Well, Mr. Chair.
In their time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question is, I guess, you know, if we're going to dive straight into markup or hearing the bill and moving the bill, are under normal circumstances, particularly in a budget year, the targets are out there in advance for the minority party to be able to react to it. And I guess what I'm hearing, and I would hope that I'm not hearing this correctly, but that we're going to be moving a bill possibly the same day that a target comes out, or maybe even after a target comes out. Is that, am I misconstruing what I just heard?
Representative Nash, I am not privy to when they're going to be released. When the amendment comes out, you'll have an idea what our target is, but because that's the bill will be built up to what we can spend, but we're still working on that piece of it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'd like to formally complain about that. I mean, we're being asked to entertain this bill, and I can imagine that this is not something of your doing, but this is troubling that we're going to be moving out a bill of this from this committee that has spending in it after we've already funded state government, and we're going to be now doing that without a target having been articulated by the majority party from the Ways and Means chair, the majority leader, or the speaker. So just want to make sure that the record reflects that that we've got problems with that, and I would hope that most Minnesotans have problems with that.
So noted, Representative Nash. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your sharing with the committee your inability to share what your leadership has sent to you about the targets. But just from a public transparency perspective, not targeted at you, but I have to share in this committee that, take the speaker's words for it, that's just crap on top of crap. Holding back from the public what the majority how they intend to handle our state responsibilities, and having us try to push bills through where we don't know what the budget targets are, how we're going to handle the surplus that the people expect, some tax reform, and to do the state's business, but you're keeping us in the dark. To quote the speaker, that's crap on top of crap. And, you know, I hope the public is watching, because this is a ridiculous way to run the state government. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. With that, members, seeing no further hands and no further, like I said, next week, you know where we're at and where we're headed. So with that, members, we're adjourned.